Chapter 10. The Well of Lost Plots. Due to the specialized tasks undertaken by PROS resource operatives, Juristech is permitted to build gadgets deemed outside the usual laws of physics, the only department, aside from the SF genre, licensed to do so. Aside from the famed travel book, Juristech is also responsible for the textual sieve, an extremely useful device that can do almost anything, even though its precise use, form, and function are never fully explained. As soon as we were back at the jurisfiction offices in Norland Park, I gave Thursday 5 an hour off for lunch, so I could get some work done. I pulled all the files on potential transfictional probe appearances and discovered I had the only solid piece of evidence. All the rest had merely been sightings. It seemed that whenever a Goliath probe appeared, it was gone again in under a minute. The phenomenon had begun 7 years ago, reached a peak 8 months before, and now seemed to be ebbing. Mind you, this was based on only 36 sightings, and so couldn't be considered conclusive. I took the information to Bradshaw, who listened carefully to my report and to what I knew about Goliath, which was quite a lot, and none of it good. He nodded soberly as I spoke, and when I had finished, paused for a moment before observing,
"Goliath is outlander, and well beyond our jurisdiction. I'm loath to take it to Senator Jobsworth, as he'll instigate some daft initiative or something with resources we just don't have. Is there any evidence that these probes do anything other than observe? Throwing a metal ball into fiction is one thing. Moving a person between the two is quite another."
"None at all," I replied. "But it must be their intention, even if they haven't managed it yet."
"Do you think they will?"
"My uncle could do it. And if he could, then it's possible." Bradshaw thought for a moment.
"We'll keep this to ourselves for now. With our plunging read rates, I don't want to needlessly panic the CFG into some insane knee-jerk response. Is there a chance you could find out something from the real world?"
"I could try," I replied reflectively. "But don't hold your breath. I'm not exactly on Goliath's Christmas card list."
"On the contrary," said Bradshaw, passing me the probe. "I'm sure they'd be overjoyed to meet someone who can travel into fiction. Can you check up on the Jane Austen refits this afternoon? Isambard was keen to show us something."
I told him I'd go down there straight away, and he thanked me, wished me good luck, and departed. I had a few minutes to spare before Thursday 5 got back, so I checked the card index databases for anything about super readers, of which there was frustratingly little. Most super reader legends had their base in the text sea, usually from word fishermen home on leave from scrawl trawlers. The issue was complicated by the fact that one super read is technically identical to a large quantity of simultaneous reads, so only an examination of a book's maintenance log would identify whether it had been a victim or not. Thursday 5 returned exactly on time, having spent the lunch hour in a mud bath, the details of which she felt compelled to tell me, at length. Mind you, she was a lot more relaxed than I was, so something was working. We stepped outside, and after I argued with Transgenre Taxi's dispatch for 5 minutes, we read ourselves to the Great Library, then took the elevator and descended in silence to the sub-basements, which had been known colloquially as the Well of Lost Plots for so long that no one could remember their proper name, if they'd ever had one. It was here that books were actually constructed. The laying of the spine was the first act in the process, and after that, a continuous series of work gangs would toil tirelessly on the novel, embedding plot and subtext within the fabric of the narrative. They carefully lowered in the settings and atmosphere before the characters, fresh from dialogue training and in the presence of a skilled imaginator, would record the book onto an Imagino-Transfero recording device, ready for reading in the Outland. It was slow, manpower-intensive, and costly. Any supervising book engineer who could construct a complex novel in the minimum of time and on budget, was much in demand.
"I was thinking," said Thursday Five as the elevator plunged downward, "about being a bit more proactive. I would have been eaten by that tiger, and it was, I must confess, the 7th time you've rescued me over the past day and a half."
8th, I pointed out. "Remember you were attacked by that adjectivore?"
"Oh, yes. It didn't really take to my suggestion of a discussion group to reappraise the passive role of grammarcites within the book world, now did it?"
"No. All it wanted was to tear the adjectives from your still-breathing body."
"Well, my point is that I think I need to be more aggressive."
"Sounds like a good plan," I replied. "If a situation arises, we'll see how you do." The elevator stopped, and we stepped out. Down here in the well, the sub-basements looked more like narrow Elizabethan streets than corridors. It was here that purveyors of book construction-related merchandise could be found displaying their wares in a multitude of speciality shops that would appeal to any genre, style, or setting. The corridors were alive with the bustling activity of artisans moving hither and thither in the gainful pursuit of book-building. Plot traders, backstoryists, hole stitchers, journeymen, and generics trotted purposefully in every direction, and cartloads of prefabricated sections for proto-books were being slowly pulled down the center of the street by pitman ponies, which are a sort of shorthand horse that doesn't take up so much room. Most of it was salvage. In the very lowest sub-basement was the text sea, and it was on the shores of this ocean that scrapped books were pulled apart by work gangs using nothing more refined than hammers, chains, and muscle. The chunks of battered narrative were then dismantled by cutters, who would remove and package any salvageable items to be resold, any idea, setting, or character that was too damaged or too dull to be reused was unceremoniously dumped in the text sea, where the bonds within the sentences were loosened until they were nothing but words, and then these, too, were reduced to letters and punctuation, the meaning burning off into a bluish mist that lingered near the foreshore before evaporating.
"Who are we going to see?" asked Thursday Five, as we made our way through the crowded throng.
"Bradshaw wanted me to cast an eye over the Jane Austen refit," I replied.
"The engineer in charge is Isambard Kingdom Buñuel, the finest and most surreal book engineer in the WOLP. When he constructed War and Peace, no one thought that anything of such scale and grandeur could be built, let alone launched. It was so large an entire sub-basement had to be constructed to take it. Even now, a permanent crew of 20 is needed to keep it going." Thursday Five looked curiously around as a gang of riveters walked past, laughing loudly and talking about a spine they'd been working on.
"So once the book is built, it moves to the Great Library?" she asked.
"If only," I replied. "Once completed and the spark has been ignited, it undergoes a rigorous 12-point narrative safety and compliance regime before being studiously and penetratively test-read on a special rig. After that, the book is taken on a trial reading by the Council of Genres Book Inspectorate before being passed, or not, for publication." We walked on and presently saw the book maintenance facility hangars in the distance, rising above the low roofs of the street like the airship hangars I knew so well back home. They were always full. Book maintenance carried on 24/7. After another 5 minutes' walk, and with the street expanding dramatically to be able to encompass the vast size of the complex, we arrived outside the book maintenance facility.